From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
And I can remember clearly when they had a press conference on this. And Johnny Cochran said at that press conference that if the NFL wasn't willing to negotiate this, then it must be litigated. And with that, the NFL responded by creating a diversity committee. And they asked Mr. Dan Rooney at the time, before, of course, he's Ambassador Rooney now, to be the chairman of this committee. So Johnny, Cyrus, and I, and Kellen Winslow, who has always been outspoken, right? Kellen Winslow, all of us went up to New York and we met to sit and talk.
John Wooden, chairman of the Fritz Pollard Alliance, an affinity group that works in conjunction with the National Football League as it relates to minority hiring and coaching, scouting, and front office positions. Since 1926, Americans have recognized Black History annually, first as Negro History Week and later as Black History Month. What you may not know is that Black history had barely begun to be studied or even documented when the tradition began. Although African Americans have been in this country since colonial time, it was not until the 20th century that they gained a somewhat respectable presence in history books. We owe the celebration of Black History Month and, more importantly, the study of Black history to Dr. Carter G. Woodson. Woodson was disturbed to find in his studies that history books rarely covered the African American population, and when they did, it was generally in ways that reflected the inferior social position they were assigned at the time. In 1915, Woodson and the Reverend Jesse Moreland founded the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, now called the Association for the Study of Afro-American Life and History, and a year later founded the widely respected Journal of Negro History. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Four Who Made a Difference with John Wooden, Michelle Martin, the Honorable Ron Kirk, and the late Joyce Ann Brown, In Black America.
I grew up in New York, as you mentioned, and New York is a 3 in 4 newspaper town. And my parents are big newspaper. We're sadly, my dad's deceased, but we're always big newspaper readers. There are always newspapers around the house, and they were always reading newspapers. And so we just grew up with it as something important. In fact, my uncle he's also sadly deceased, was career Air Force. And my aunt tells a story about her and my uncle coming home from home on home leave from some place where they were stationed. I think they were stationed at the time. And my mother and she were talking in the kitchen. And, you know, at that age, you know, kids aren't supposed to interrupt adults. But she tells this funny story about Mike coming in and saying, "Excuse me, can I have the New York Times, please, if you're not going to read it?" You know? And I was like something like 9 or something crazy like that. So I just think I grew up with the news, really interested in my parents, very interested in public affairs. They don't have a lot of formal education, but always really interested in public affairs. And then when I was in college, I just got very interested in it, was working at one of my off-campus, one of my many work-study jobs, I'll say that, when I was in college, was working at the Urban League. And I got really interested in, you know, I was working on their newsletter there just as one of their hired hands. And I just got really interested in the fact that a lot of what they were talking about in the office and a lot of what they were talking about in the community was not something that I was seeing a lot of in the papers at that time.
Michelle Martin, weekend host of NPR's All Things Considered. Black History Month is a one-month-a-year festival of lectures, exhibit, historical films, and community activities that celebrate the great story of survival and continued creativity of African Americans. But when February ends, the cultural festivals often end, and Black history seems to disappear for another 11 months. African-American historians say it doesn't have to be that way. Here at In Black America, we chronicle the African-American experience 52 weeks a year. Over the past 4 decades, I've had the pleasure of covering many of the historical moments in African-American history, and I've spoken with many of those newsmakers. On today's program, I selected 4 of those achievers. Although the selection was difficult, I do believe they are worthy of our attention. When he was drafted in 1959 by the Cleveland Browns, John Wooden's addition to the team proved to be one of the most important drafts in the history of the franchise. Wooden played for the Browns from 1959 to 1967, then went to Washington Redskins from 1967 to 1968. During the off seasons of 1960 to 1963, he was a junior high school teacher. His NFL career didn't stop on the field. He continued by becoming director of pro scouting with the Dallas Cowboys from 1975 to 1991. He created player program, player development programs for the NFL in 1971. He served as vice president of player personnel for the Philadelphia Eagles and also served as assistant director of pro college scouting for the Baltimore Ravens until his retirement in 2002. Wooten has been involved with the NFL for some 48 years, and he currently serves as the chairman of the Fritz Pollard Alliance, an affinity group that works in conjunction with the National Football League as it relates to minority hiring and coaching, scouting, and front office positions.
We've seen the whole thing, John. When we came in the National Football League in 59, there wasn't an African-American anywhere except the players and those cleaning up the locker room. There were no front office people. I think Burl Toler and a few guys like that were officials. But there was really no African-American or minority person in what we call the decision-making position. Football, so wasn't any assistant coaches and so forth. And you might as well take the position that I take. That I was under, came up in. I never had a black coach in high school, in college, or in NFL. I never had a black coach on the staff that I played under. So consequently, you would think that I would say, well, everything's okay, you know. But I didn't see it that way, you know. I saw the fact that there were people that I'd seen and surrounded myself with that I felt were very capable. I never wanted to be a coach, period. But I knew that there were a lot of guys, you know, not only players, but that I'd been around that I thought were good coaches. And yet they weren't given that opportunity. So as we grew and moved in, and in particular, Tank Younger, who, if you look at things, you'll hear me refer to him a lot. Tank Younger, of course, came out of Grambling, one of the real big power football players in the National Football League, the first player from a historical black college to be a player in the NFL and go on to be a front office guy. The thing that Tank did was inspiring to me was that he was always talking about how we got to work together, how we got to pull for ourselves and help each other no matter what. And one of the things that I remember that was so key of him saying to us, you know, scouts and so forth, is if you know a kid can play football and your team is getting ready to release him, call somebody else on other teams and tell them to grab this guy. You know, don't just let him go on back to Detroit or Mississippi, wherever he is, knowing that he's a good player. Give him another chance and so forth. And I just thought that was very, very admirable, you know, that here he was taking the position of help somebody else, even though you don't get any benefits from it. Mm-hmm. Just the fact that you helped him to have an opportunity to go somewhere else and play when you know he can play. And that's the key thing in terms of why we push so strongly to our coaches and our front office people is being prepared to move up this pipeline so that when you get an opportunity, you will immediately be ready for it, you know, because you can't throw away the factors. You're not going to get that many chances to fail, you know. You see it all over everywhere. Then if you get wiped out, you're wiped out. So you got to be prepared for the opportunity when it arrives so that, you know, everything goes out that way.
What did you do to prepare yourself for life after playing in the NFL?
Not bragging, but when I came in the National Football League, and this goes back to my teaching as a young guy growing up, and this is what I give the full credit to people like Mr. Smith, Emmett Smith is his name, you know, who was our principal, our math teacher, our coach. He did everything there at Carver, okay? Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Mantooth, who was our math teacher in English and typing and so forth, and Mrs. Hardwick and Mr. Irving, and those were our teachers. But what they taught us really, really cared over of being prepared. And I can remember going to Carlsbad High School as a sophomore, and I was saying to myself, okay, I'm going in here and I'm going to show them that I'm just as smart as they are. That when they get up on the board in algebra or chemistry, I can do all of that too. I know all of that just like they know it. Even though I'm coming from Carver and they're coming from Eisenhower or Alta Vista, the junior highs that feed into there, I will show them that I can do the work just like they can do it and so forth. That I can come in here and be a top student.
John Wooten, chairman of the Fritz Pollard Alliance. Michelle Martin has spent more than 25 years as a journalist, first in print, where she spent more than a decade covering state and local politics for the Washington Post and national politics and policies at the Wall Street Journal, where she was White House correspondent. She has also been a regular panelist on the PBS series Washington Week and a contributor now with Bill Moyers. In 1992, Martin joined ABC News, where her primary assignment was with Nightline, where she served as correspondent from 1996 to 2006, reporting on such subjects as the congressional budget battle, the U.S. embassy bombing in Africa, racial profiling, and the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, Martin graduated cum laude from Radcliffe College at Harvard University in 1980 and has done graduate work at Wellesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. In 2006, Martin came to NPR to launch Tell Me More, a one-hour daily NPR news and talk show that aired on NPR stations nationwide from 2007 to 2014. She is currently the weekend host of NPR's All Things Considered.
I started out in print, and I guess I just liked finding stuff out and telling people. I mean, I grew up in New York, as you mentioned, and New York is a 3-in-4 newspaper town. And my parents are big newspaper. We're sadly, my dad's deceased, but we're always big newspaper readers. There are always newspapers around the house, and they were always reading newspapers. And so we just grew up with it as something important. In fact, you know, my uncle was also sadly deceased, was career Air Force. And my aunt tells a story about her and my uncle coming home from home leave from some place where they were stationed. I think they were stationed at the time. And my mother and she were talking in the kitchen. And, you know, at that age, you know, kids aren't supposed to interrupt adults. But she tells a funny story about my coming in and saying, "Excuse me, can I have the New York Times, please, if you're not going to read it?" You know? And I was like something like 9 or something crazy like that. So I just think I grew up with the news, really interested in my parents, very interested in public affairs. They don't have a lot of formal education, but always really interested in public affairs. And when I was in college, I just got very interested in it, was working at one of my off-campus, one of my many work-study jobs, I'll say that, when I was in college, was working at the Urban League. And I got really interested in, you know, I was working on their newsletter there just as one of their hired hands. And I just got really interested in the fact that a lot of what they were talking about in the office and a lot of what they were talking about in the community was not something that I was seeing a lot of in the papers at that time. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't understand that. So, you know, the arrogance of youth, I said, well, I'll fix that. You know, I'll write an article. I'm going to fix that. And I just got hooked on it. I think I just got hooked on that whole idea of finding stuff out and telling people about it. I think that's just what I like. I like talking to people.
Covering the local beat in Washington at the Washington Post, tell us some of the most enjoyable stories that you had a chance to cover.
Well, I covered everything. I mean, I don't know if it's still like that, but the Post at that time really prided itself on, you know, like everything, both really, really local and really, really national, right? Of course. And so, of course, being a little baby reporter, you cover the really, really local. I remember covering one of the first births of like quintuplets or something. Like, I think it was quintuplets. I think it was a lady had quintuplets, and that was considered such a huge deal at the time that I went, you know, to their house to cover the story. And they showed me how, like, they had built, like, this special addition onto their house so that they could kind of feed all the kids at once and all this stuff. And I just was floored by this. You know, I thought to myself, how do you do that? How do you take care of 5 babies at once? So that obviously stuck with me for a reason, since I later had twins. And, of course, now, you know, having twins myself, if people have 3, I'm amazed. Like, how can you do that? How could you possibly do that? In a way that, of course, when people have a singleton, they're amazed at me. You know, they say, how could you possibly do that? You just do. So that was just, for some reason, that stuck with me. All kinds of interesting stories. I remember one of the first big demonstrations by what later became a really significant organization, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, because they were protesting at a live poultry store. And it will probably, those of you who know the Washington, D.C. area will know that the area that this live poultry store was in is now in an extremely kind of what we call rapidly gentrifying, quickly becoming fancy neighborhood that was a couple of blocks from our old NPR office. So you can imagine when, you know, years later, and I'm working at NPR, I was amazed to go by this, what used to be the Arrow Live Poultry store, where this demonstration was this group that nobody had ever heard of before called PETA, picketing this store. And now it's a very posh restaurant.
When you left the Post, you went to the Wall Street Journal. Everyone sees scandal. Anything familiar? You've been a White House correspondent?
Well, all right. I will let you in on a little... A little known fact, which is that the woman that is upon whom scandal is loosely based, I have to say very loosely based, because to my knowledge, you know, no one in her shop has ever killed anyone or caused them to be killed. And I know for a fact, to the degree that I can know anything as a fact, I know she did not have an affair with the president. But the then deputy press secretary at the time was a woman named Judy Smith, and who was the deputy press secretary when I covered the White House. So I know Judy Smith very well. And in fact, some years later, I owe her a great debt of gratitude because she introduced me to the man who is now my husband. So that's a little trivia for you. You can drop that at a cocktail party if you want.
What made you make the transition from print to ABC News in 1992?
I was just interested in it. I was just, I think like you, I was just interested in it. And I just wanted to know what it was like being part of a press corps at the White House. You see people in all media.
Michelle Martin, weekend host of NPR's All Things Considered. As the former United States Trade Representative, Ambassador Ron Kirk was a member of President Obama's cabinet and served as the president's principal trade advisor, negotiator, and spokesperson on trade issues. Kirk is the first person of African-American descent to hold that position. Kirk has more than 30 years of diverse legislative and economic experience on local, state, and federal levels. As the first African-American mayor of Dallas, Texas from 1995 to 2001, he earned a reputation for bringing together diverse coalitions to get things done. Born and raised in Austin, Texas, Ambassador Ron Kirk is the son of a postal worker and public school teacher who were steeped in civil rights activities and Austin politics. He received a Bachelor of Arts degree in political science and sociology from Austin College in Sherman, Texas. And in 1979, he earned a law degree from the University of Texas Law School. Former Governor Ann Richard appointed him Secretary of State. He served as a legislative aide to U.S. Senator Lloyd Benson and was named a chair of the Texas General Service Commission. Also, Kirk served as the City of Dallas Assistant City Attorney.
You know, I grew up humble. I grew up in a very strong family there in East Austin. I was blessed to have parents who both worked. My mother was a school teacher. My father worked at the post office. But they put four kids through school. I was the youngest one. And you know, for all of us, work was, you know, just a way of life. And so I'd been working since I was 14 years old, and I took any job I could get. And in law school, I clerked, you know, at a small firm there, Broadus, Spivey, and Dickey Grigg, but I also worked as a researcher at a group called the House Study Group there in Austin to help pay for my legal education. And when I finished law school, I moved to Dallas in 1979, practiced law for a number of years. You know, I mentioned my friends Rodney Ellis and John Hall, who at the time was a district director for Lloyd Benson, came to me and said, "Hey, Senator Benson is really looking to diversify his staff in Washington." And they encouraged me to look at that. And even though I was still committed to being a lawyer, and I was at that time I had a very active trial lawyer practice, I was also cognizant of the fact that I'd spent my whole career in Texas. I'd gone, you know, from Austin to Sherman and back to Austin and then to Dallas, and I thought it wouldn't kill me to see how the rest of the country was. And so I accepted that offer in 1980. I moved to Washington to join the legislative staff of then U.S. Senator Lloyd Benson.
Tell us how you navigated D.C. coming from Austin, which was basically maybe about 45-50.
Oh, Alex, Austin wasn't 45% African American. I don't even think Austin was 10%. You know, it was eye-opening. You know, and I tell people, but that's part of why I encourage young people to travel and see something different. Because, you know, many of my classmates at the law school, even at Austin College, who had moved from the Northeast, just couldn't fathom how we'd grown up in the segregated South. And many of us couldn't comprehend the world in which they were like, oh, yeah, we run this stuff. And I remember, you know, it's funny because back then, which now I'm dating myself, I'm not as old as John Hanson, listeners, but I can see him from here. But it's hard for our kids to understand life before the internet and cell phones and any of that stuff. And so I would call home once a month and, you know, talk to my dad and my brother, and I was, you know, I'm sure it's going to sound politically incorrect, but I sound like that kid in the movie. I see black people everywhere. But it was refreshing because, when you unfortunately, sometimes you grow up in communities in which you're always the only one. You can have that risk. As my father used to warn us again, don't get enamored with being the first and the only one, because you know a lot of us belong in that room. You're just privileged to be there, and so it was kind of refreshing to not always be the only person of color in the room, but to realize there are talented people of all faiths and ethnicities everywhere. And in that sense, Washington was absolutely enchanting and liberating for me.
Ron, in 1995, you threw your hat in the ring to become mayor of Dallas. What led you to that decision?
Well, John, by that time, as you mentioned, I had, you know, had a career in law. I then spent some time working in Washington on Senator Benson's staff. And what brought me back to Dallas was the city of Dallas actually recruited me and asked me to come back and help them sort of beef up and run their intergovernmental affairs program. Mm-hmm. So I had spent 6 years in the city attorney's office and then left, gotten married, had a couple of kids. And as you know, our great friend, Ann Richards, who was a wonderful friend and mentor, had become governor of Texas. And it was Governor Richards that appointed me secretary of state. And during that time, the mayor of Dallas announced he would not run for reelection. And I frankly thought of everything I'd seen and been privileged to do in government, that I'd always said that I thought one of the best jobs in government was to be the mayor of a big city. And, you know, I hope it doesn't sound arrogant, but I looked at that race and that opportunity and thought, you know, if not now, when? And I thought, I can do this.
The Honorable Ron Kurt, former U.S. Trade Ambassador and Dallas, Texas Mayor, and Senior of Counsel in Gibson, Dunn, Crutcher, LLP. In 1980, the late Joyce Ann Brown was convicted of aggravated murder in Dallas, Texas, based on testimony from a witness who identified her from a photograph. She had been a suspect when police learned that a car used in the crime had been rented by someone named Joyce Ann Brown. Unfortunately, the Joyce Ann Brown who rented the car and the Joyce Ann Brown whom the police arrested were different persons. An eyewitness wrongly identified the Brown who were arrested, and that Joyce Ann Brown was charged with the crime. Before trial, police and prosecutors discovered the error but proceeded with the prosecution anyway. Brown was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. After an investigation by Centurion Ministry and an expose by 60 Minutes, her conviction was reversed because police and prosecutors had failed to turn over exculpatory evidence in their possession. In 1990, all charges were dismissed. Although the organization she founded, Mass Incorporated, Brown has effectively served thousands of clients and families with offices in Dallas, Fort Worth, and Washington, D.C. to help break the cycle of recidivism, crime, and poverty among formerly incarcerated individuals. Brown died on June 13, 2015. She was 68.
I had no idea I was going to be there 9 years, 5 months, and 24 days. Every time, every day that telephone would ring in that pipe chase, I would think that was for me, saying I was going home. It wasn't until the first appeal was turned down that I realized that these people did not care as to whether I was innocent or guilty. All they wanted to know is, did they take me to court fairly? How can you take a person that didn't commit a crime to court fairly? 20 years has passed and nobody has never answered that question. And so it wasn't like I thought that I was going to be there a long length of time. But what I did was made sure that I continued to research. I got in the law library, research and fight for Joyce Brown.
Once you were released, who were some of the individuals that assisted you in getting your life back on track?
My family, of course, because I have a $1 million family, not in money, but in love and in support. Commissioner Price. Everybody had told my mother that we're going to help her, we're going to get her a job, we're going to do this. When I came home talking about this system and changes that needed to be made. And so everybody was either on the phone or out of town. 20 years later, they're still on the phone or out of town. I was at a breakfast for KKDA with Willis Johnson and some others, and Commissioner was there. And he asked me if I was working, and then I was kind of angry because everybody was asking. Nobody was doing anything, so I said, I'm looking. And so he gave me a card. He said, call my office. I said, yeah, okay. And so I didn't call. And about 3 days later, when I did call, the young lady asked, have you called here? I said, no. He said, would you please tell him that when you come in? And so I said, yeah. And so I came in, and he was on the phone and signing papers and talking and working and just moving around and talked to me for a minute. Then he says, after he had asked me a few questions, I'll never forget, he gave me $100 bill and said, go have lunch on me and I'll call you. He said, I'll call you later. And so I said, yeah. And when I walked out, I said, well, at least I got my foot in the door. I never expected to receive a call. By the time I got home, there was a message on the answer machine that says, come tomorrow morning, prepare to go to work. And so when I walked in that next morning, I worked for 10 years. So when I say that Commissioner was my support when I came home, and that was because he really didn't have a position. He created a position.
The late Joyce Ann Brown, founder of Mass Incorporated. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.